I began to see my home through new eyes. We don't have medieval hilltop towns here, but we do have bucolic seasonal decor, and we are not afraid to use it. Look, I cried to my family, we live in Pleasantville. They were forced to agree. Every store window had its own cheerful autumnal arrangement to celebrate the season. The lamp posts on Main Street had corn shocks tied around them with bright orange ribbons. The police station had a scarecrow out front. As I have mentioned, yard art is an earnest form of self-expression here. Autumn, with its blended undertones of joyful harvest and trick-or-treat kitsch, brings out the best and worst on the front lawns. Colorful displays of chrysanthemums and gourds. A large round hay bale with someone's legs hanging out of its middle. A pair of jeans and boots stuffed with newspaper, I can only hope. We'll call it a farm safety reminder. One common theme runs through all these dioramas, and that is the venerable pumpkin. They were lined up in rows, burnished and proud and conspicuous, the big brass buttons on the uniform of our village. On the drive home from our morning's errands, we even passed a pumpkin field where an old man and a younger one worked together to harvest their crop, passing up the orange globes and stacking them on the truck bed to haul to market. We'd driven right into a Norman Rockwell painting. Every dog has its day, and even the lowly squash finally gets its month. We may revile zucchini in July, but in October we crown its portly orange cousin, the king cucurbit and doorstop supreme. In Italy, I had nursed a growing dread that my own country's food lore had gone over entirely to the cellophane side. Now my heart was buoyed. Here was an actual, healthy, native North American vegetable, non-shrink-wrapped, locally grown and in season, sitting in state on everybody's porch. The little devil on my shoulder whispered, "Oh yeah? You think people actually know it's edible?" The angel on the other shoulder declared, "Yeah." Too smugly for an angel, probably, the very next morning, for I opened our local paper to the food section and found a colorful 2-page spread under the headline, Pumpkin Possibilities. Pumpkin curry soup, pumpkin satay. The food writer urged us to think past pie and really dig into this vitamin-rich vegetable. I was excited. We'd grown 3 kinds of pumpkins that were now lodged in our root cellar and piled on the back steps. I was planning a special meal for a family gathering on the weekend. I turned a page to find the recipes. As I looked them over, Devil sneered at Angel and kicked butt. Every single recipe started with the same ingredient, 1 can, 15 ounces, pumpkin. I could see the shopping lists now. 1 can pumpkin for curry soup. 1 of those big orangey things for doorstep. Come on, people. Doesn't anybody remember how to take a big old knife, whack open a pumpkin, scrape out the seeds, and bake it? We can carve a face onto it, but can't draw and quarter it? Are we not a nation known worldwide for our cultural zest for blowing up flesh on movie and video screens and or armed conflict? Are we in actual fact too squeamish to stab a large knife into a pumpkin? Wait till our enemies find out. 2 days later, my mother walked in the kitchen door, catching me in the act of just such a murder, and declared, "Barbara, that looks dangerous." I studied my situation objectively. The pumpkin was bluish, not from asphyxiation, but clinging tenaciously to life. I was using a truly enormous butcher knife, but keeping my fingers out of harm's way. "Mom, this is safe," I insisted. "I have good knife skills." Where her direct descendants are concerned, my mother's opinion is that a person is never too old to lose digits or eyesight in the normal course of events. Dad is another story. To be frank, he's the reason Mom's worry skills remain acutely honed. Naturally, he wanted to get in on the act here. "Step right up," I said. My father's career before he retired covered most kinds of emergency surgery imagined in the 20th century, carried out in operating rooms that occasionally did not come equipped with electricity. I wasn't going to argue with his knife skills. The pumpkin kept the two of us sawing and sweating for a good 30 minutes while we made no appreciable progress. Our victim was a really large pumpkin of the variety called Queensland Blue. The seed catalog had lured me in with testimonials about its handsome, broad-shouldered Aussie physique and tasty yellow flesh. Next year, Amadeo's warty Zucca di Chioggia would get to vie for the World Cup title of our pumpkin patch, but for now the Queensland Blue ruled, and this one was not yielding. My surgical assistant and I sawed some more, taking frequent breaks to review and strategize. I lusted in my heart after one of those 1-can, 15-ounces pumpkin recipes. Cooking pumpkin from scratch may not be for the faint-hearted, but it's generally not that hard. I wasn't merely trying to hack it to pieces. If that had been our goal, Dad would have dispatched it in no time flat. But I was being girly, insisting on cutting open the top as neatly as possible to scoop out the seeds and turn the whole thing into a presentable tureen in which to bake pumpkin soup. I have two different cookbooks that feature this as a special guest recipe. Meanwhile, we received plenty of advice from the bystanders. What are families for? All boiling down to the opinion that it would taste exactly the same if we just smashed it. But this was a special dinner, and I was doing it up right. "You'll see, go away," I said sweetly, waving my knife. I never went to chef school, but I know what they say. Presentation, presentation, presentation. Our occasion was Thanksgiving, declared a month early, since all of us wouldn't be able to convene on the actual day. Turkeys galore were now wedged into our freezer, post-harvest, but today's family gathering included some vegetarians who would not enjoy a big dead bird on the table, however happily it might have lived its life. Meatless cooking is normal to me. I was glad to make a vegetarian feast. But today, as hostess, I felt oddly pressed by tradition to have some kind of large, autumnally harvested being, not just ingredients, as the centerpiece for our meal. A hearty pumpkin soup baked in its own gorgeous body would be just the thing for a turkeyless Thanksgiving. Or so I'd thought, before I knew this one would not go gentle into that good night, as Dylan Thomas advised. Even our meanest roosters hadn't raged this hard against the dying of the light. At length, Dad and I ascertained the problem was our Queensland Blue, which was almost solid flesh, lacking the large open cavity in its center that makes the standard jack-o'-lantern relatively easy to open up. We finally performed something like trephination on our client, creating a battle-weary but still reasonably presentable hollowed-out tureen. I rubbed the cavity with sea salt and poured in milk I'd heated with plenty of sage and roasted garlic. Regular, lactose-free, or soy milk work equally well. I set it carefully into the oven to bake. According to the recipe, after an hour or so of baking, I could use a large spoon to scrape gently at the inside of the tureen, stirring the soft, baked pumpkin flesh into the soup. I'll now add my own cautions to this recipe. Don't scrape too hard, and don't overbake. I confess I may have hoped for a modest flutter of kiss-the-cook applause as I set our regal centerpiece on the table, instead of the round of yelping and dashes for the kitchen towels that actually ensued. The whole thing collapsed. Fortunately, I'd baked it in a big crockery pie dish. We saved the tablecloth and 9/10 of the soup. My loved ones have eaten my successes and failures since my very first rice pudding at age 9, for which I followed the recipe to the letter but didn't understand the 1 cup rice had to be cooked first. Compared with that tooth-cracking concoction, everyone now agreed, my pumpkin soup was great. Really, it was. By any standards except presentation, which I flunked. And besides, what is the point of a family gathering if nobody makes herself the goat of a story to be told at countless future family gatherings? Along with Camille's charred lasagna, our own fresh mozzarella, and the season's last sliced tomatoes, we made a fine feast of our battered centerpiece. If anyone held Dad and me under suspicion of vegetable cruelty, they didn't report us. We remain at large.
Trading Fair and Square by Stephen Hopp. The local food movement addresses many important interconnected food issues, including environmental responsibility, agricultural sustainability, and fair wages to those who grow our food. Buying directly from small farmers serves all these purposes, but what about things like our pumpkin pie spices or our coffee that don't grow where we live? We can apply most of the same positive food standards, minus the local connection, to some imported products. Coffee, tea, and spices are grown in environmentally responsible ways by some small-scale growers, mostly in the developing world. We can encourage these good practices by offering a fair wage for their efforts. This approach, termed fair trade, has grown into an impressive international effort to counter the growing exploitation of farmers in these same countries. Consumer support for conscientious, small growers helps counter the corporate advantage and sustains their livelihoods, environments, and communities. Coffee is an example of how fair trade can work to the advantage of the grower, consumer, and environment. As an understory plant, coffee was traditionally grown under a shaded mixture of fruit, nut, and timber trees. Large-scale, modern production turned it into a monoculture, replacing wild forests with single-crop fields, utterly useless as wildlife habitat, doused heavily with fertilizers and pesticides. This approach is highly productive in the short term, but causes soil erosion and kills tropical biodiversity, including the migratory birds that used to return to our backyards in summer, not to mention residual chemicals in your coffee. In contrast, farmers using traditional growing methods rely on forest diversity to fertilize the crop, from leaf litter, and help control coffee pests from the pest predators that are maintained. Although their yields are lower, the shade-grown method sustains itself and supports local forest wildlife. Selecting shade-grown and fair-trade coffee allows these small farm growers a chance to compete with larger monocrop production and helps maintain wildlife habitat. Independent certification agencies, similar to those that oversee organic agriculture, ensure that fair-trade standards are maintained. As demand grows, the variety of products available has also grown to include chocolate, nuts, oils, dried fruits, and even hand-manufactured goods. For more information, see transfairusa.org, fairtrade.net, or ifat.org.
A pumpkin is the largest vegetable we consume. Hard-shelled, firm-fleshed, with fully ripened seeds, it's the caboose of the garden train. From the first shoots, leaves, and broccoli buds of early spring, through summer's small soft tomato, pepper, and eggplant fruits, then the larger melons, and finally the mature hard seeds, such as dry beans and peanuts, it's a long and remarkable parade. We had recently pulled up our very last crop to mature, peanuts, which open their orange pea-like flowers in midsummer, pollinate and set their seeds, and then grow weirdly long, down-curved stems that nose-dive the seed pods earthward, drilling them several inches into the soil around the base of the plant. Many people do realize peanuts are an underground crop. Their widespread African name is groundnut. Although few ever pause to ruminate on how a seed, product of a flower, gets under the dirt. In case you did, wonder no more. Peanuts are the dogged overachievers of the plant kingdom, determined to plant their own seeds without help. It takes them forever, though. Our last ritual act before frost comes is to pull up the peanut bushes and shake the dirt from this botany freak show snack food. We were ready now for frost to fall on our pastures. We had eaten one entire season of botanical development in the correct order. Months would pass before any new leaf poked up out of the ground. So now what? Another whole category of vegetable used to carry people through winter before grocery chains erased the concept of season. This variant on vegetable growth is not an exception, but is auxiliary to the leaf, bud, flower, fruit, seed botanical time-lapse I initially posted as the vegetannual rule for thinking about what's in season. A handful of food plants are not annuals, but biennials. Their plan is to grow all summer from a seed, lay low through one winter, then burst into flower the following spring. To do it, they frugally store the sugars they've manufactured all summer in a bulky tuber or bulb that hides underground waiting for spring after their leaves have died back. Humans thwart them opportunistically, murdering the plant and robbing its savings account just when the balance is fattest. Carrots, beets, turnips, garlic, onions, and potatoes are all the hard-earned storage units of a plant that intended to live another season in order to fulfill its sexual destiny. As a thrifty person myself, raised to trust hard work, I feel like such a cheat when I dig the root crops. If I put emotion in charge of my diet, I would not only be a vegetarian, I'd end up living on air and noodles like a 3-year-old, because I also feel sorry for the plants. In virtuous green silence, they work as hard as any chicken or cow. They don't bleat or wail as we behead them, rip them from their roots, pull their children from their embrace. We allow them no tender mercies. But heaven help me, I eat them like nobody's business. Root crops are the deliverance of the home food devotee. Along with dry beans and grains, they bring vegetable nutrition into months when nothing else fresh is handy. Because they store well, it's easy enough for gardeners to produce a year's worth in the growing season. Some of my neighbors grumble about the trouble of growing potatoes when a giant bag at the store costs less than a Sunday newspaper. And still, every spring, we are all out there fighting with the cold, mucky late winter soil, trying to get our potatoes in on schedule. We're not doing it for the dimes we'll save. We know the 50-pound bag from the store tastes about like a Sunday newspaper, compared with what we can grow. A batch of tender new Carolas or red golds, freshly dug in early summer, is its own vegetable, waxy, nutty, and sweet. Peruvian blues, Russian banana fingerlings, Yukon golds. The waxy ones hold together when boiled and cut up for potato salad. Others get fluffy and buttery colored when baked. Still others are ideal for oven roasting. A potatophile needs them all. The standard advice on potato planting time is the same as for onions and peas, as early as the soil can be worked. That is a subjective date, directly related to impatience. I always get stirred up around St. Patrick's Day and go through my annual ritual of trooping out to the potato bed with a shovel, sticking it in the ground, and scientifically discerning that it's still a half-frozen swamp. You don't need a groundhog for that one. Wait a few more weeks. We generally get them in around the 1st of April. Potato plants don't mind cool weather as long as they're not drowning. They were bred from wild ancestors in the cool, dry, equatorial Andean highlands, where days and nights are equal in length year-round. They don't respond to changes in day length to control their maturity. Other root crops are triggered by summer's long days to start banking starch, preparing for winter ahead. In fact, onions are so sensitive to day length, onion growers must choose their varieties with a latitude map. Temperatures are not a reliable cue, They can rise and fall capriciously during a season, giving us dogwood winter, Indian summer, and all the other folklorically named false seasons. But no fickle wind messes with the track of the sun. It's a crucial decision for a living thing, when exactly to shut down leaf growth and pull all resources down into the roots to stock up for winter. A mistake will cost a plant the chance to pass on its genes. So in temperate climates, evolution has tied such life-or-death decisions to day length. Animals use it also to trigger mating, nesting, egg-laying, and migration. But potatoes, owing to their origin in the summerless, winterless, high-altitude tropics, evolved without day-length cues. Instead, they have a built-in rest period that is calendar-neutral, and until it's over, the tubers won't sprout, period. I learned this the hard way, early in my gardening career, when I planted some store-bought potatoes. I waited as the weather grew warm, but no sprouts emerged. Potatoes are often treated with chemicals to keep them dormant, but I'd planted organic ones with no such excuse for sloth. After about a month, I dug them up to see what in the heck was going on with the lazy things. I'm much more relaxed with my children, I swear. My potatoes were still asleep. Not one eye was open, not a bump, shoot, or bud. Now I know. Potatoes have a pre-programmed nap time which cannot for any reason be disturbed. Seed potatoes aren't ready to plant until after they've spent their allotted months in cool storage. I had assumed a spring potato was a spring potato, but these I'd bought from the grocery in March must have been harvested recently in some distant place where March was not the end of winter. The befuddlements of a seasonless vegetable universe are truly boundless. If the potatoes in the produce section are already sprouting, on the other hand, it means they're ready to get up. They're edible in that condition, as long as they haven't been exposed to light and developed a green cast to the skin. Contrary to childhood lore, these photosynthesizing potatoes won't kill you, but like all the nightshades, including tomatoes and eggplants, all green parts of the plant contain unfriendly toxins and mutagens. Sprouting and a tad wrinkly, though, they're still okay to eat. Rolled in a sturdy paper bag in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator, they'll keep 6 months and more. But when I open our labeled bags of seed potatoes in April, I always find a leggy mess, the whole clump spiderwebbed together with long sprouts. That means the wake-up call has come. We toss them in the ground and hill them up. From each small potato grows a low, bushy plant with root nodules that will grow into 8 or more new potatoes. Fingerling potatoes produce up to 20 per hill, though they're smaller. The plants have soft leaves and a flower ranging from white to pink or lavender, depending on the variety. In the Peruvian Andes, where farmers still grow many more kinds of potatoes than most of us can imagine, I've seen fields of purple-flowered potatoes as striking in their way as a Dutch tulip farm in bloom. The little spuds in the roots continue to gain size until the plant gets tired and dies down 4 to 5 months after planting. Few garden chores are more fun for kids than recovering this buried treasure at the end of the season. We plant 8 different kinds, plus a mongrel bag that Lily calls the Easter egg hunt when we dig them. I turn up each hill with a pitchfork and she dives in after the red, blue, golden, and white tubers. For my part, it's a cross between treasure hunt and ER, as I have to shout, "Clear!" every time I dig, to prevent an unfortunate intersection of pitchfork and fingers. Even though the big score comes at summer's end, we'd already been sneaking our hands down into the soil under the bushy plants all summer to cop out little round baby spuds. This feels a bit like adolescent necking antics, but is a time-honored practice described by a proper verb, grabbling. Magazine editors want to change it to grabbing. Writers try to forgive them. The proper time for doing it is just before dinner. Like corn, new potatoes are sweetest if you essentially boil them alive. In late summer, we'd finished digging the Yukon Golds, All Blues, and other big storage potatoes, best for baking. In September, we'd harvested the fingerlings, yellow finger-shaped gourmet potatoes that U.S. consumers have discovered fairly recently. I found them in a seed catalog, ordered some on a whim, and got hooked. The most productive potato in our garden is a fingerling adored by the French, called by a not-so-romantic name, La Rotte. Means what it sounds like. The name baffled me until I grew them. When a mature hill is uncovered, it looks like a nest of 15 suckling baby rodents, all oriented with their blunt noses together in the center and their long tails pointed out. By virtue of incredible flavor and vigor, these little rats take over a larger proportion of my potato patch every year. By October, all our potatoes were in the root cellar, along with the beets, carrots, and sweet potatoes, a tropical vine botanically unrelated to potatoes. Our onions were harvested, too. We pull those up in late summer after their tall, strappy tops begin to fall over, giving the patch an off-the-shoulder look, with the bulbs bulging sensuously above the soil line. Comparisons with a Wonder Bra are impossible to avoid. By the time they're fully mature, onions are pushing themselves out of the ground. It's an easy task on a dry late summer day to walk down the row tugging them up, leaving them to cure in the sun for the afternoon, then laying them on newspapers for a couple of weeks in a shed or garage with plenty of air circulation. Garlic gets a similar treatment. No matter how well it's ventilated, the aroma of the curing shed gets intense. In earlier days, children would have been made to sit in there to cure the category of ailment my grandmother called the epizooty. She also used to speak of children wearing asafoetida bags around their necks to prevent colds. Genuine asafoetida is a European plant in the parsley family, but the root word is fetid. Garlic obviously worked as well, the medicinal property being that nobody would get close enough to your children to cough on them. As they used to say in New York, a nickel will get you on the subway, but garlic will get you a seat. In fairness to its devotees, I should point out that real medicinal value has been attributed to garlic, stemming from its antibacterial sulfur compounds and its capacity to break down fibrin and thin the blood. The Prophet Muhammad recommended it for snake bite. Eleanor Roosevelt took it in chocolate-covered pills to improve her memory. And Pliny the Elder claimed it was good for your sex life. I wouldn't bet on that last one. We stick to culinary uses. When the tops of the cured garlic and onions have faded from green to brown but are still pliable, and their odor has tamed, I braid them into the heavy skeins that adorn our kitchen all winter. The bulbs keep best when they're hung in open air at room temperature, and we clip off the heads as we need them, working from the top down. Garlic is the spice of life in our kitchen. Spaghetti sauce, lasagna, chicken soup, just about everything short of apple pie begins with some minced cloves of garlic sautéed in olive oil. I spend it as the currency of our culinary happiness, cutting off the heads week by week, working the braids slowly down to their bottom ends, watching them like the balance of a bank account. With good management, we'll reach the end in midsummer, just as the new crop gets harvested. But we always come down the home stretch on empty. Garlic, like the potato, is a more subtle vegetable than most people know, since most groceries carry only one silver skin variety that keeps like Egyptian royalty. Garlic connoisseurs know the rest of the story. Seed Savers Exchange lists hundreds of varieties, each prized for its own qualities of culture and flavor. They fall into two basic categories. The lusty, primitive hardnecks have escaped. A flower stalk that shoots up from the center of the bulb in early spring, striking an incomprehensibly circular path, growing itself into something like an overhand knot before it blooms. The more domestic soft necks are better for braiding and storage. Beyond this, garlics are as hard to categorize as red and white wines, with equally enthusiastic legions of fans. Enchilium red has taken first place in taste tests on several continents. Red Toch, according to my seed catalog, has a multidimensional quality, a spicy fragrance, and consummate flavor. Persian Star, obtained from a bazaar in Samarkand, Uzbekistan, has a mild spicy zing. Brown Tempest starts hot and intense, then simmers down to a warm, pleasant finish. Music is rich and pungent. Chestnut Red is the best for baking, very aromatic with an abiding flavor. Elephant is just plain huge. Who can decide? A sucker for Seed Catalog Pros, I ordered 6 varieties and planted about a dozen cloves of each. Buried under the soil with a blanket of straw mulch on top, each clove would spend the winter putting out small fibrous roots. The plant begins working on top growth in early spring, as soon as air temperatures rise above freezing. By midsummer, it will have from 8 to a dozen long leaves, with one clove at the base of each leaf nestled into the tight knot of a new head. I pull them in late June and tend to think of that moment as the end of some sort of garden fiscal year. It never really stops, this business of growing things. Garlic goes into the ground again in October, just as other frost-killed crops are getting piled onto the compost heap. Food is not a product, but a process, and it never sleeps. It just goes underground for a while. October seeded to us the unexpected gifts of a late first frost. A few more weeks of tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and basil. Usually it's late September when the freeze comes to knock these tender plants down to black stalks, a predictable enough event that still somehow takes us by surprise every time. The late evening newscast predicting it will create a mild hubbub in the neighborhood, sending all the gardeners out in the chill to scoop up green tomatoes and pull peppers in the dark. Both peppers and eggplants are tropical by nature, waking slowly to summer and just getting into full swing in late September. We were happy for the October bonus, bringing in bushels of blocky orange, red, and yellow peppers at our leisure instead of under siege. In the evenings, we built fires in the patio fire pit and lined the peppers up shoulder to shoulder on the grill like sunbathers on a crowded beach. The heat makes their skins sear and bubble. Afterward, we freeze them by the bagful, so their smoky flavor can lively up our homemade pizzas all winter. If it's the scent of burning leaves that invokes autumn for most people, for us, it's roasting peppers. My most nostalgic harvest rituals from childhood are of the apple variety. My parents took us on annual excursions to a family-owned orchard in the next county where we could watch cider being pressed and climb into the trees to pick fruit that the clay-footed adults couldn't reach. We ate criminal quantities of apples up in the boughs. Autumn weather still brings that crisp, greenish taste to the roof of my mouth. I realized other members of my family must share this olfactory remembrance of things past when our October gathering spontaneously rallied into a visit to an apple orchard near our farm. We bought bushels, inspired to go home and put up juice and apple butter. I don't know what rituals my kids will carry into adulthood, whether they'll grow up attached to homemade pizza on Friday nights or the scent of peppers roasting over a fire, or what. I do know that flavors work their own ways under the skin, into the heart of longing. Where my kids are concerned, I find myself hoping for the simplest things. That if someday they crave orchards where their kids can climb into the branches and steal apples, the world will have trees enough with arms to receive them.
Splendid Spuds by Camille. Dietitians seem to love or hate potatoes. This vegetable is a great source of quality carbohydrates that will keep you feeling energized and satisfied, or else it should be avoided because its sinful starchiness will make you gain weight like crazy. So, which is it? First, it's not safe to generalize. The Idaho spuds at grocery stores are just the tip of the iceberg. I've eaten potatoes ranging from gumball to guinea pig size, golden, brick red, or even brilliant blue. When you dig those out of the ground, they look almost black, but after a good scrub, they have a deep purplish shine you would expect in a jewelry store, not under layers of caked mud. I'm always amazed to slide my knife into the first Peruvian blue of the season, finding its insides as vivid as a ripe blueberry. As it happens, the phytochemical responsible for the gorgeous color of blueberries and blue potatoes is the same one, a powerful antioxidant. Some anti-aging facial products on the market feature mashed blueberries as a main ingredient. Nobody in my household has tried rubbing potatoes on her face to preserve a youthful complexion, but we take them internally, appreciating all the nutrients in our potato rainbow. Even white potatoes, eaten with their skins, give us vitamins C and B6 and nearly twice the potassium per serving as a banana. The potato's bad rep comes from its glycemic index, or GI, a tool used to rate the increase in blood sugar caused by eating particular foods. Foods with a high GI, like sugar and corn sweetener also, cause a sharp rise in blood glucose that stimulates high levels of blood insulin. It's hard on the body when that happens frequently and has been linked to type 2 diabetes. But if potatoes are eaten along with foods containing some fiber, protein, and fat, those lower the body's glycemic response so the insulin levels stay calm. A potato's nutritional value is a package best delivered in its own wrapper. Unfortunately, eating potato skins is not always safe. Because they grow underground, conventional potatoes are among the most pesticide-contaminated vegetables. Potatoes in the United States commonly contain chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticides and sometimes even residues of DDT, dieldrin, and chlordane, extremely hazardous chemicals that have been banned since 1978 but linger in the soil. Conventionally grown potatoes are so contaminated, the Environmental Working Group warns parents not to feed them to infants and toddlers unless they're thoroughly peeled and boiled. This makes a strong case for buying organic potatoes from trustworthy growers who know the history of the land where their produce is raised. We're lucky enough to have homegrown. Potato salad is one dish our household never goes without, although it changes with the seasons. We eat many other root vegetables too, and plenty of sweet potatoes and winter squash in the autumn months. I've included Mom's infamous pumpkin soup recipe along with potato salad recipes on our website. Autumn Meal Plan. Sunday, grilled steak and fall potato salad. Monday, sweet potato and charred quesadilla. Tuesday, twice baked potatoes with cheese and late season broccoli. Wednesday, Spanish tortilla. Thursday, three bean soup with fresh bread. Friday, pizza with tomato sauce, turkey sausage, roasted onions, and mozzarella. Saturday, cheese and squash quiche.
Chapter 17. Celebration Days. November, December. The closing down season of the year set us to dragging out storm windows and draining outdoor pipes, but Lily had a whole different agenda. Her egg enterprise opened for business. Her April chicks had matured into laying hens, surprising us with their first eggs in late October. Winter is the slow season for egg laying, with many breeds ceasing production altogether when the days are less than 13 hours long. We'd counseled Lily not to expect much from her flock until next spring. Never underestimate the value of motivational speeches from the boss. Lily shot out of bed extra early every morning so she'd have time to spend in the chicken coop before the school bus came. Her hens have special nest boxes that open from outside the chickens' roosting quarters, so it's possible to stand in clean shoes in the front room of the poultry barn and reach through to collect the eggs. Or in Lily's case, to stand for hours peering in, supervising the hens at their labors. She actually has watched eggs exiting the hens' oviducts, a sight few people on earth have yet checked off their to-do lists, I imagine. When planning this flock, she had chosen antique, heavy-bodied breeds with good reputations for laying right through cold weather. By mid-November, she was bringing in as many as a dozen eggs a day from her 19 layers. Lily apparently knew all along that her workforce could actualize its potential. She had also been working her customer base for months, taking phone numbers in advance. A CEO wears many hats, accountant, supervisor, egg scrubber, but this company's special strength was public relations. Advance planning had taken into account not just winter production, but also egg color. The products from her different breeds of hens crossed a palette from soft green to pink, tan, and chocolate brown. Lily arranged them so every carton contained a rainbow and printed out her own label, Lily's Lovely Layers, with a photo of herself holding one of the lovelies. She pasted this over the Brand X names on the recycled cartons friends had saved for her. By the time she made her first sale, customers were practically lined up in the driveway. Lily was beside herself, dancing around the kitchen with her first dollars. Seeing my young entrepreneur realize her dream made me feel proud, too, and also mystified, in the way of all parents who watch their kids acquire skills beyond our ken. When I was that age, the prospect of selling even a Girl Scout cookie mortified me to tears. Now I watched my 9-year-old stand a couple of inches taller each time she picked up the phone to arrange an egg pickup, always remembering first to ask, "How are you today, and how's your family?" In the evenings, she sat down at the kitchen table with the account book I'd helped her set up to keep track of customer information, inventory, and expenses. Finally, she was entering numbers in the income column. I soon wondered if I'd have to walk down the driveway and get in line myself. I reminded Lily that our family still needed eggs, too. We'd stayed well supplied for the past year from her 3 old pet hens, which I had presumed were not going to go on payroll. But now their eggs went straight into the lovely layer cartons with all the rest. They could be mine, I learned, for $2.50 a dozen. Taking into account the cost of feed, this price gave Lily a small profit margin and still pleased her customers. I, however, balked at it. Of course, I didn't mind rewarding my hard-working daughter. That wasn't the problem. She had been diligent about caring for her hens, closing them safely into their coop every night, even cracking ice off their water bowl on cold mornings. She kept her ears permanently tuned to the chicken voices outside, so knew immediately when a coyote had crept into the yard and barreled screaming for the front door before the rest of us had a clue. I don't know about the coyote, but I nearly needed CPR. These hens owed their lives and eggs to Lily. There was no question. But since she was taking her business so seriously, I wanted her to understand it genuinely. Businesses have startup costs. I reminded her that I'd paid for the chicks and also the feed they'd eaten for 6 months before they started laying. Grazing hens still need supplementary protein, calcium, and other nutrients. I explained to Lily about capitalization, credit, and investors. She listened with interest. "I'll pay you back," she said immediately. "I want the business to be really mine, not just some little kid thing." She sat down with her ledger to figure the size of the zero-interest loan I'd fronted in venture capital. We had the receipts. We have to buy organic feed in bulk, so we'd already purchased all she'd need until next spring. What she had to calculate was the cost of 32 mail-order chicks and the edible wages required to keep the layers producing one full year. Roosters had been dispatched. I wondered myself what the figure would be. She bent over her ledger for a long time, pigtail ends brushing the table as her pencil scratched, erased, and scratched some more. Finally she spoke. $285! She rolled out of her chair, flopping dramatically onto the floor, eyes squeezed shut and tongue thrust out to convey either despair or grave fiscal alarm. As I said, a CEO wears many hats. "Don't panic," I said, sitting down beside her on the floor. "Let's talk about this." She opened one eye. "Mom, I won't make that much till I'm 50 or something." "Trust me, you will. It's not as much as it sounds. Plus, if we're keeping track of everything, I owe you for the roosters we ate and all the eggs we've used since April. I forgot about that. Add those up and we'll see where we are." Where we were at the beginning of November was just under $155 in debt. Lily and I made a deal. She would give me all the eggs I wanted, subtracting $2.50 per carton from her debt. I would not charge interest, but I would ask to be considered a priority customer. No standing in line. At 2 cartons a week, she'd be debt-free in about 30 weeks. To a fourth grader, that sounds roughly the same as life without parole. "But you'll still be earning real money from all your other customers," I pointed out. "You'll be opening a bank account before you know it, and everybody's going to need extra eggs for our baking with the holidays coming up." Cheered by the prospect of holiday baking, the corporate executive officer took the situation in hand. As far as I know, the workforce was never apprised of the crisis. Of all holidays we celebrate in the United States, few come with food traditions that are really our own. Most of the holy days and bank holidays on our calendar have come from other cultures, some of them ancient, others too modern to have settled yet into having their own menus. The only red-blooded American holiday food customs, it seems to me, arrive on the 4th of July and Thanksgiving. They couldn't be more different. The first is all about charring things on a grill, burgers and hot dogs and the like, washed down with plenty of beer or soda, the purpose being to stay outdoors for long afternoon, culminating at dusk in elaborate explosions of gunpowder. Aside from the flagpole that may be somewhere in the scene, there is nothing about this picnic that's really rooted in our land. The pyrotechnics are Chinese, technically, and the rest of the deal is as packaged as food can be. That might even be what's most American about it. At the end of a 4th of July party, if asked to name the sources of what we'd consumed, we'd be hard-pressed to muster an ingredient list. The other holiday is all about what North America has to offer at the end of a good growing season. Thanksgiving is my favorite, and always has been, I suppose because as a child of the farmlands, I appreciate how it honestly belongs to us. On St. Patrick's Day, every beer-drinking soul and his brother is suddenly Irish. Christmas music fills our ears with tales of a Palestinian miracle birth, a generous Turkish saint whom the Dutch dressed in a red suit, and a Druid ceremonial tree, I think. But Turkey Day belongs to my people. Turkeys have walked wild on this continent since the last ice age, whereas old Europe was quite turkeyless. That fact alone scored them nearly enough votes to become our national bird. But in the end, I guess looks do matter. Corn pudding may be the oldest New World comfort food. Pumpkins and cranberries, too, are exclusively ours. It's all American, the right stuff at the right time. To this tasty native assembly add a cohort of female relatives sharing work and gossip in the kitchen. Kids flopped on the living room floor watching behemoth cartoon characters float down a New York thoroughfare on TV. and men out in the yard pretending they still have the upper body strength for lateral passes, and that is a perfect American day. If we need a better excuse to focus a whole day on preparing one meal, eating it, then groaning about it with smiles on our faces, just add a dash of humility and hallelujah. Praise the harvest. We made it through one more turn of the seasons. In modern times, it's mostly pageantry, of course, this rejoicing over harvest and having made it to winter's doorstep with enough food. But at our house this year, the harvest was real and the relief literal. Also, for the first time since we'd begun our local food experiment, we approached a big dining event for which the script was already written. Local turkey? We had some whose lives began in the palms of our hands and ended 12 steps from the back door. Pumpkin pies, mashed potatoes, corn pudding, sweet potatoes, green beans, celery, and chestnuts for the stuffing? How could it be this easy? On our continent, this party plans itself. I had no complaint about celebrating Thanksgiving twice, this time carnivorously. Any excuse to spend a day with friends and my husband and kids is good with me, and I'm partial to the traditional menu. I love carving up Tom on the table and then revisiting him throughout the following weeks in sandwiches, soups, and casseroles. I have such a fondness for the stuffing. My post-Thanksgiving bliss in childhood was to make stuffing sandwiches. Dr. Atkins rollover. Our recipe starts with a skillet full of sautéed onions, garlic, homegrown celery, and chestnuts from our Chinese chestnut, tossed with a whole loaf of Stephen's wheat bread torn to pieces, softened with stock, and spiced with loads of sage and thyme. We started the evening before, baking several loaves of bread and checking the progress of our thawing bird. I also hacked a Queensland blue handily to pieces. 10 minutes flat, revenge is sweet, to cook down for pumpkin pies. Lily helped roll out the dough. Both girls have always helped with Thanksgiving dinner since they were tall enough to stand on a chair and mix the stuffing with their hands like a splendid mud pie. 1 year earlier, at ages 8 and 17, they had taken responsibility for an entire holiday meal when I was sidelined with a broken leg. With some heavy lifting help from Stephen, they pulled it off beautifully, turkey, pies, and all. Cooking is 80% confidence, a skill best acquired starting from when the apron strings wrap around you twice. On Thursday morning, we baked the pies. In the afternoon, we roasted sweet potatoes, braised winter squash, sautéed green beans with chestnuts, boiled and mashed the potatoes, all while keeping a faithful eye on Mr. T. By herself, Lily cracked half a dozen eggs into a bowl, subtract $1.25 from the I.O. Mama column, and made the corn pudding, using corn we'd cut from the cob and frozen in summer. Our garden provided everything, with one exception. Cranberries mostly grow farther north. I'd planted a small experimental cranberry patch, but had nothing yet to show for my efforts. We discussed a cranberry-less Thanksgiving and agreed that would be like kissing through a screen door. Who needs it? Did we need it? Was it essential that this feast be 100% pure Hopsolver grown? Personal quests do have a way of taking on lives of their own, even when nobody else knows or cares. Recreational runners push themselves another mile. Scrabblers keep making bigger words. Our locavore project nudged us constantly toward new personal bests, but it always remained fascination, not fanaticism. We still ate out at restaurants with friends sometimes, and happily accepted invitations to dine at their homes. People who knew about our project would get flustered sometimes about inviting us, or when seeing us in a restaurant would behave as if they'd caught the cat eating the canary. We always explained, we're converts in progress, not preachers, no stone tablets. Our Thanksgiving dinner would include a little California olive oil, a pinch of African nutmeg, and some Virginia flour that likely contained wheat from Pennsylvania and points north. Heeding the imperatives of tradition, we also bought a bag of lipstick-colored organic cranberries from Wisconsin. As the first store-bought fruit or vegetable to enter our house in many months, they looked wildly exotic, lounging on our counter, dressed in their revealing cellophane bag. All of us, I think, secretly fondled them before Camille cooked them into a gingery sauce. Our guests came over in the afternoon to hang out in the kitchen and inhale while everything roasted and braised. We had given away some of our harvested bourbon reds, but Mr. Thanksgiving had been chosen while still on his feet, headed all his life for this appointment with our table. He weighed 18 pounds, even without the mega breast that the broad-breasted whites push around. Historic breeds tend to have proportionally more dark meat, and true to type, this guy made up for his narrower chest with a lot of leg, thigh, and overall heft. His color and texture were so different from the standard turkey, it's hard to compare them. He was a pleasure to cook, remaining exceptionally moist and tender. Thanks to a thin layer of egg yolk-colored fat under the skin of the breast, the meat seemed to baste itself and gained a delicate aroma and flavor reminiscent, I swear, of lobster. The prices these birds earn on the specialty market are deserved. Taste is the reason for the success of Slow Food USA's Turkey Project, through which customers sign up in springtime for heritage breed turkeys delivered by farmers at Thanksgiving. This bourbon red, we and our friends agreed when we bit into him, was the richest, most complex flavored turkey we had eaten. But a perfect turkey is no more important than any other part of this ritual. Lighting the candles, passing the gravy, telling some of the same stories every time. Eating until you swear you are miserable, and then happily eating dessert, too. In addition to the pumpkin pies, our friend Marushka brought a strudel she had learned to make as a young girl in Slovenia. She apologized for its shape, explaining that for holidays it was supposed to be turned like a horseshoe, but she didn't have the right pan. Everyone told her, of course, that it didn't matter, it would taste the same. But I understood her longing to recreate in every detail a comestible memory. It's why we'd needed the cranberries for the tart pinky tinge that oozes into the gravy and makes everything Thanksgiving. It's why we go to the trouble to make a meal with more vegetable courses than many people consume in a week, and way more bird than anyone needs at one sitting. Having more than enough, whether it came from the garden or the grocery, is the agenda of this holiday. In most cases, it may only be a pageant, but holidays are symbolic anyway, providing the dotted lines on the social contract treasure map we've drawn up for our families and nations. As pageantry goes, what could go more to the heart of things than this story of need, a dread of starvation, and salvation arriving through the unexpected blessing of harvest? Even feigning surprise, pretending it was unexpected, and saying a ritual thanks is surely wiser than just expecting everything so carelessly. Wake up now, look alive, for here is a day off work just to praise creation. The turkey, the squash, and the corn, these things that ate and drank sunshine, grass, mud, and rain, and then in the shortening days laid down their lives for our welfare and onward resolve. There's the miracle for you, the absolute sacrifice that still holds back seeds, a germ of promise to do the whole thing again another time. Oh, yes, I know the Squanto story. We replayed it to death in our primitive grade school pageantry. Pilgrim friends, bury one fish beneath each corn plant. But that hopeful affiliation ended so badly, I hate to keep bringing it up. Bygones are what they are. In my household credo, Thanksgiving is creation's birthday party. Praise harvest. A pause and sigh on the breath of immortality. Snow fell on our garden in December, leaving the dried corn stalks and withered tomato vines standing black on white like a pen and ink drawing titled Rest. I postponed looking at seed catalogs for a while. Those of us who give body and soul to projects that never seem to end, child-rearing, house-cleaning, gardening, know the value of the occasional closed door. We need our moments of declared truce. The farmer's market closed for the year. We paid our last call to the vendors there, taking phone numbers and promising to keep in touch for all kinds of reasons. We would miss our regular chats. We would need advice about the Icelandic sheep we were getting in the spring. We might drive out sometimes to get winter greens from their cold frames. We stocked up on enough frozen meat to see us through winter, including a hefty leg of lamb for one of our holiday dinners. The tunnel of winter had settled over our lives, ushered in by that great official hoodwink, the end of daylight savings time. Personally, I would vote for one more hour of light on winter evenings instead of the sudden extra early blackout. Whose idea was it to jilt us this way, leaving us in cold November with our unsaved remnants of daylight petering out before the workday ends? In my childhood, as early as that, I remember observing the same despair every autumn, the feeling that sunshine, summertime, and probably life itself had passed me by before I'd even finished a halfway decent tree fort. But mine is not to question those who command the springing forward and the falling back. I only vow each winter to try harder to live like a potato, with its tacit understanding that time is time, no matter what any clock might say. I get through the hibernation months by hovering as close as possible to the wood stove without actual self-immolation, and catching up on my reading, cheered at regular intervals by the excess of holidays that collect in a festive logjam at the outflow end of our calendar. We are a household of mixed spiritual backgrounds, and some of the major holidays are not ours, including any that commands its faithful to buy stuff nobody needs. But we celebrate plenty. We give away our salsas and chutneys as gifts and make special meals for family and friends. Turkey and stuffing, leg of lamb with mint jelly and roasted root vegetables tossed with rosemary and olive oil. For New Year's Day, the traditional southern black-eyed peas and rice for good luck